concern at the moment. It's his hands. He stands there staring at his hands, lost in the prospect of them. Never before has he been so intrigued by the lines across his palms. Isn't one of them supposed to be a lifeline? Shouldn't the lifeline of a tithe divide out like the branches of a tree? Lev looks at the swirls of his fingerprints. What a nightmare of identification it must be when other people get in Unwine's hands. What can fingerprints mean when they're not necessarily yours? No one will be getting Lev's fingerprints. He knows this for a fact. There are tons of activities for the tithes, but unlike the Terribles, no one is forced to participate. Part of preparation for tithing is a month-long regimen of mental and physical assessments even before one's tithing party, so all the hard work is done at home before they get here. True, this isn't the harvest camp he and his parents had chosen, but he's a tithe. It's a lifetime pass that's good anywhere. Most of the other tithes are in the rec room at this time of the evening, or in any number of prayer groups. There are pastors of all faiths in the tithing house. Ministers, priests, rabbis, and clerics. Because that notion of giving the finest of the flock back to God is a tradition as old as religion itself. Lev attends as often as necessary, and in Bible study he says just enough of the right things so as not to look suspect. He also keeps his silence when Bible passages become shredded to justify unwinding, and kids start to see the face of God in the fragments.
My uncle got the heart of a tithe, and now people say he can perform miracles.
I know this woman who's got a tithe's ear. She heard a baby crying a block away and rescued it from a fire.
We are Holy Communion.
We are manna from heaven. We are the peace of God in everyone. Amen. Lev recites prayers, trying to let them transform him and lift him up like they used to, but his heart has been hardened. He wishes it could be hard enough to be diamond instead of crumbling jade. Maybe then he'd have chosen a different path. But for who he is now, for what he feels and what he doesn't feel, the path is right. And if it's not right, well, he doesn't care enough to change it. The other tithes know Lev is different. They've never seen a fallen tithe before, much less one who, like the prodigal son, has renounced his sins and returned to the fold. But then, tithes don't generally know many other tithes. Being surrounded by so many kids just like them feeds that sense of being a chosen group. Still, Lev is outside of that circle. He turns the treadmill on, making sure his strides are steady and his footfalls as gentle as can be. The treadmill is state-of-the-art. It has a screen with a programmable vista. You can jog through the woods or run the New York Marathon. You can even walk on water. Lev was prescribed extra exercise when he arrived a week ago. That first day, his blood tests showed high triglyceride levels. He's sure that Mai's and Blaine's blood tests showed the same problem as well, although the three of them were captured independently and arrived a few days apart from one another, so no connection among the three of them could be made.
Either it runs in your family or you've had a diet high in fats, the doctor had said.
He prescribed a low-fat diet during his stay at Happy Jack and suggested additional exercise. Lev knows there's another reason for the high triglyceride level. It's not actually triglyceride in his bloodstream at all, but a similar compound, one that's a little less stable. Another boy enters the workout room. He has fine hair so blonde it's practically white, and eyes so green there must have been some genetic manipulation involved. Those eyes will go for a high price.
Hi, Lev.
He gets on the treadmill next to Lev and begins running.
What's up?
Nothing. Just running. Lev knows the kid didn't come here of his own accord. Tithes are never supposed to be left alone. He was sent here to be Lev's buddy.
Candle lighting will be starting soon. Are you coming?
Every evening a candle is lit for each tithe being unwound the next day. The honored kids each give a speech. Everyone applauds. Lev finds it disgusting.
I'll be there, Lev tells the kid.
Have you started working on your speech yet?
He asks.
I'm almost done with mine.
Mine's still in bits and pieces, Lev says.
The joke goes over the kid's head. Lev turns off the machine. This kid will not leave him alone as long as he's here,
And Lev really doesn't want to talk to him about the glory of being a chosen one. He'd rather think about those who aren't chosen and are lucky enough to be far from the harvest camp, like Risa and Connor, who to the best of his knowledge are still in the sanctuary of the graveyard. It's a big comfort to know that their lives will continue even after he's gone. There's an old trash shed behind the dining room that's no longer in use. Lev found it last week and decided it was the perfect place for secret meetings. When he arrives that evening, Mai is pacing the small space. She's been getting more and more nervous each day.
"How long are we going to wait?"
she asks.
"Why are you in such a hurry?" Lev asks.
"We'll wait until the time is right." Blaine pulls out 6 small paper packets from his sock, tears one open, and pulls out a little round band-aid.
"What's that for?"
Mai asks.
"For me to know and for you to find out."
"You're so immature."
Mai always has a short fuse, especially when it comes to Blaine. But tonight there seems to be more rumbling beneath the surface of her attitude.
"What's wrong, Mai?" Lev asks.
Mai takes a moment before answering.
"I saw this girl today playing piano on the chop shop roof. I know her from the graveyard, and she knows me."
"That's impossible. If she's from the graveyard, why would she be here?"
asks Blaine.
"I know what I saw, and I think there are other kids here I know from the graveyard, too. What if they recognize us?"
Blaine and Mai look to Lev as if he can explain it.
Actually, he can. "They must be kids who were sent out on a job and got caught, that's all."
Mai relaxes.
"Yeah. Yeah, that must be it."
"If they recognize us," says Blaine, "we can say the same thing happened to us."
"There," says Lev. "Problem solved."
"Good," says Blaine. "Back to business. So, I'm thinking we go for the day after tomorrow, on account of I'm scheduled for a game of football the day after that, and I don't think it'll go very well."
Then he hands 2 of the little band-aids to Mai and 2 to Lev.
"What do we need band-aids for?"
Mai asks.
"I was told to give these to you after we got here."
Blaine dangles one from his fingers, like a little flesh-colored leaf.
"They're not band-aids," he says. "They're detonators."
There was never a job on an Alaskan pipeline. After all, what unwind would volunteer for such a job? The whole point was to make sure no one but Lev, Mai, and Blaine volunteered. Their van had taken them from the graveyard to a run-down house in a run-down neighborhood where people who had been run down by life plotted unthinkable deeds. Lev was terrified of these people, and yet he felt a kinship with them. They understood the misery of being betrayed by life. They understood what it felt like to have less than nothing inside you. And when they told Lev how important he was in the scheme of things, Lev felt, for the first time in a long time, truly important. The word evil was never used by these people, except to describe the evils of what the world had done to them. What they were asking Lev, Mai, and Blaine to do wasn't evil.
No, not at all.
It was an expression of all the things they felt inside. It was the spirit and the nature and the manifestation of all they had become. They weren't just messengers. They were the message. This is what they filled Lev's mind with, and it was no different than the deadly stuff they filled his blood with. It was twisted. It was wrong. And yet it suited Lev just fine.
"We have no cause but chaos,"
Cleaver, their recruiter, was always so fond of saying. What Cleaver never realized, even at the end of his life, is that chaos is as compelling a cause as any other. It can even become a religion to those unlucky enough to be baptized into it. Those whose consolation can only be found in its foul waters. Lev does not know of Cleaver's fate. He does not know or care that he himself is being used. All Lev knows is that someday soon, the world will suffer a small part of the loss and the emptiness and the utter disillusionment he feels inside. And they will know the moment he raises his hands in applause. 58. Connor. Connor eats his breakfast as quickly as he can. It's not because he's hungry, but because he has somewhere else he wants to be. Risa's breakfast hour is right before his. If she's slow and he's quick, They can force their paths to cross without attracting the attention of the Happy Jack staff. They meet in the girls' bathroom. The last time they were forced to meet in a place like this, they took separate, isolated stalls. Now they share one. They hold each other in the tight space, making no excuses for it. There's no time left in their lives for games, or for awkwardness, or for pretending they don't care about each other. And so they kiss as if they've done it forever, as if it is as crucial as the need for oxygen. She touches the bruises on his face and neck, the ones he got from his fight with Roland. She asks what happened. He tells her it's not important. She tells him she can't stay much longer, that Dalton and the other band members will be waiting for her on the chop shop roof. "I heard you play," Connor tells her. "You're amazing." He kisses her again. They don't speak of unwinding. In this moment, none of that exists. Connor knows they would take this further if they could, but not here, not in a place like this. It will never happen for them, but somehow he's content in knowing that in some other place and time, it would have. He holds her for 10 seconds, 20, 30. Then she slips away, and he returns to the dining hall. In a few minutes he hears her playing, the strains of her music pouring forth, filling Happy Jack with the upbeat, pulse-pounding soundtrack of the damned. 59. Roland. They come for Roland that same morning, right after breakfast. A harvest counselor and two guards corner him in the dormitory hallway, isolating him from the others.
"You don't want me?" Roland says desperately. "I'm not the Akron AWOL. Connor's the one you want."
"I'm afraid not," says the counselor.
But I've only been here a few days."
He knows why this happened. It's because he hit that guy with the volleyball, that must be it. Or it's because of his fight with Connor. Connor turned him in. He knew Connor would turn him in.
"It's your blood type," the counselor says. "AB negative? It's rare and in very high demand."
He smiles.
"Think of it this way. You're worth more than any other kid in your unit."
"Lucky you," says one of the guards as he grabs Roland by the arm. "If it's any consolation," says the counselor, "your friend Connor is scheduled for unwinding this afternoon." Roland's legs feel weak as they bring him out into the light of day. The red carpet stretches out before him, the color of dried blood. Anytime kids cross that terrible stone path, they always jump over it, as if touching it were bad luck. Now they won't let Roland step off it.
"I want a priest," says Roland. "They give people priests, right? I want a priest."
"Priests give last rites," says the counselor, putting a gentle hand on his shoulder. "That's for people who are dying." "You're not dying. You'll still be alive, just in a different way."
"I still want a priest."
"Okay, I'll see what I can do."
The band on the roof of the chop shop has begun their morning set. They play a familiar dance tune as if to mock the dirge playing inside his head. He knows Risa is in the band now. He sees her up there playing the keyboard. He knows she hates him, but still he waves to her, trying to get her attention. Even an acknowledgement from someone who hates him is better than having no one but strangers watch him perish. She doesn't turn her eyes toward the red carpet. She doesn't see him. She doesn't know. Perhaps someone will tell her he was unwound today. He wonders what she'll feel. They've reached the end of the red carpet. There are 5 stone steps leading to the doors of the chop shop. Roland stops at the bottom of the steps. The guards try to pull him along, but he shakes them off.
"I need more time. Another day, that's all. One more day. I'll be ready tomorrow, I promise."
And still above him, the band plays. He wants to scream, but here, so close to the chop shop, his screams will be drowned out by the band. The counselor signals to the guards. They grab him more firmly just beneath the armpits, forcing him to take those 5 steps. In a moment, he's through the doors, which slide closed behind him, shutting out the world. He can't even hear the band anymore. The chop shop is soundproof. Somehow he knew it would be.
60. Harvest. No one knows how it happens. No one knows how it's done. The harvesting of unwinds is a secret medical ritual that stays within the walls of each harvesting clinic in the nation. In this way, it is not unlike death itself, for no one knows what mysteries lie beyond those secret doors either. What does it take to unwind the unwanted? It takes 12 surgeons in teams of two, rotating in and out as their medical specialty is needed. It takes 9 surgical assistants and 4 nurses. It takes 3 hours. 61. Roland. Roland is 15 minutes in. The medical staff that buzz around him wear scrubs the color of a happy face. His arms and legs have been secured to the operating table with bonds that are strong but padded so he won't hurt himself if he struggles. A nurse blots sweat from his forehead.
Relax. I'm here to help you through this.
He feels a sharp pinprick in the right side of his neck, and then in the left side.
What's that?
That, says the nurse, is the only pain you'll be feeling today.
This is it, then, Roland says. You're putting me under?
Although he can't see her mouth beneath her surgical mask, he can see the smile in her eyes.
Not at all, she says. By law, we're required to keep you conscious through the entire procedure.
The nurse takes his hand.
You have a right to know everything that's happening to you every step of the way.
What if I don't want to?
You will, says one of the surgical assistants, wiping Roland's legs down with brown surgical scrub.
Everybody does. We've just inserted catheters into your carotid artery and jugular vein, says the nurse. Right now your blood is being replaced with a synthetic oxygen-rich solution.
We send the real stuff straight to the blood bank, says the assistant at his feet. Not a bit gets wasted. You can bet you'll be saving lives.
The oxygen solution also contains an anesthetic that deadens pain receptors.
The nurse pats his hand.
You'll be fully conscious, but you won't feel a thing.
Already Roland feels his limbs starting to go numb. He swallows hard.
I hate this. I hate you. I hate all of you.
I understand.
28 minutes in. The first set of surgeons has arrived.
Don't mind them, says the nurse. Talk to me.
What do we talk about?
Anything you want.
Someone drops an instrument. It clatters on the table and falls to the floor. Roland flinches. The nurse holds his hand tighter.
You may feel a tugging sensation near your ankles, says one of the surgeons at the foot of the table. It's nothing to worry about.
45 minutes in. So many surgeons. So much activity. Roland couldn't remember ever having so much attention directed at him. He wants to look, but the nurse holds his focus. She's read his file. She knows everything about him, the good and the bad. The things he never talks about. The things he can't stop talking about now.
I think it's horrible what your stepfather did.
I was just protecting my mother.
Scalpel, says a surgeon. She should have been grateful.
She had me unwound.
I'm sure it wasn't easy for her.
All right, clamp it off.
1:15. Surgeons leave, new ones arrive. The new ones take an intense interest in his abdomen. He looks toward his toes but can't see them. Instead, he sees a surgical assistant cleaning the lower half of the table.
I almost killed a kid yesterday.
That doesn't matter now.
I wanted to do it, but I got scared. I don't know why, but I got scared.
Just let it go.
The nurse was holding his hand before. She's not anymore.
Strong abdominal muscles, says a doctor. Do you work out?
A clanging of metal. The lower half of the table is unhooked and pulled away. It makes him think of when he was 12 and his mom took him to Las Vegas. She had dropped him off at a magic show while she played the slots. The magician had cut a woman in half,
Her toes were still wiggling, her face still smiling. The audience gave him thunderous applause. Now Roland feels discomfort in his gut. Discomfort, a tickling sensation, but no pain. The surgeons lift things away. He tries not to look, but he can't help it. There's no blood, just the oxygen-rich solution